Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Glug after glug. As little Johnny Haig wrestled to stop the 40-gallon steel drum from tipping over too far, the thick black gloop slowly slid into the festering sewer, hidden behind the locked back door in the basement of 79 Gloucester Road. As the smoking stew slopped up the rim, the acrid stench of acid stung the air, and the last of the shapeless fatty goo oozed down into the drain. Seeing no eyes, no hair and no skin, just a yellowy-green layer of ominous grease. This was all that remained of 33-year-old William Donald McSwan. And with the manhole cover replaced, Mac was gone. Being the first of six supposedly perfect murders, although this baby-faced psychopath would soon bloom into one of Britain's most infamous serial killers, in truth, as a murder virgin, Johnny had badly bungled his first slaying. But somehow, with his deathly cherry popped, he had got away with it. But as a convicted fraudster, experienced forger, and a charming liar, the rest would be textbook.
I had known McSwan for some time, and on seeing his mother and father, I explained that he had gone off to avoid his call-up. I wrote a number of letters, purporting to be from him, and posted them in Glasgow and Edinburgh, explaining the various details of the deposition of assets,
which included a company, four homes, and seven bank accounts, worth £250,000 today. Last seen on Saturday the 9th of September 1944, as a shy, introverted recluse who hid in the shadows, Mac would be missed by nobody but his doting parents, who would swallow an entirely plausible story that their son, a shame petty criminal, an absconded parolee, a conscription deserter, and a secret homosexual, with so much to lose, would flee the city, leaving his only friend in charge of his affairs. It seemed logical, so strung along by a sweet little man that Max saw as a sibling, and for fear of leading the police to their terrified child, his timid parents kept up the pretense that their boy was away on business, all the while unwittingly aiding his murderer. And just as Johnny had done with his body, the cocky little killer would strip, dissolve, and dispose of all of Mac's assets, until not a single trace of him would ever be found. Only Mac didn't have a single penny or asset to his name. On Tuesday the 12th of September 1944, with the trifling little matter of a murder ticked off his to-do list, and Mac's sludgy remains slowly slipping its way towards one of several sewer plants across the city, after a decent night's nap, a solid breakfast, and another quick peek at a rather nifty, dark green Armstrong Siddeley saloon he had his eye on in a nearby car showroom, Johnny set about cleaning the basement. There was no real rush, though. Having rented the premises for 3 months, he had barely used a week. The landlord, Albert Marshall of Taylor Lovegrove & Co., was fully aware that any odd whiffs emanating from the floor below was due to Johnny undertaking experimental work on a government contract. And so with Mac only missing, the police wouldn't find this crime scene until 5 years later. Being a filthy basement soiled by several previous tenants, Johnny's cleanup would be at best a slapdash affair. He swept a bit, moved some stuff, and tipped a bucket of hot soapy water. But as he disliked hard work, he really wasn't all that bothered, especially now that Mac's money would soon be burning a hole in his pocket. Desperate to get the job done, Johnny had a scrap man destroy the steel drum. Canning & Co. collected the three empty bottles, and seeing no reason to waste £7 a month on a perfectly serviceable but now seemingly pointless place for a murder, Johnny sublet the dingy basement to Ronald A. Fontana, a pleasant fellow who needed the storage space and was happy to be left a few odds and sods that Johnny really couldn't be bothered to bin. You know, stuff like pinball table legs, a length of lead pipe, and an old rusty axe. In an era where the best security was a signature, becoming Mac would be no biggie. Clutching the keys he had rifled from the corpse, Johnny helped himself to a few necessary knick-knacks he had filched from Mac's ground floor flat at 22 Kempsford Gardens. A checkbook, a suitcase, some clothes, a nice pen, a few handwritten letters, a surprisingly good suit, and Mac's imperial typewriter. Not that this crime was as uncouth as a common burglary or as petty as pilfering a fridge. Johnny wouldn't stoop so low as to half-inch a few cheap trinkets to pawn off for a pound. No, these personal possessions had purpose. That aside, the banks and lawyers would be a pushover. A few stuffy old men, easily duped by a legal letter and an ID, signed in an identical scrawl. But for his superior scheme to truly work, Johnny needed Mac's parents to believe that their beloved son wasn't dead, but that he had voluntarily disappeared. And yet, with a little bit of effort, a large dollop of knowledge, a few days spare, and several pounds in his dwindling bank account, Donald and Amy McSwan swallowed it whole. And Johnny did most of it by post. But how did it work and why? Well, the McSwans weren't all that different to his own parents, the Hagues. Born in a staunchly Presbyterian house in Menstrie, a small rural village in the Scottish lowlands snuck between Edinburgh and Glasgow, Donald McSwan was the second youngest of seven siblings, to Christina, a devoted housewife, and William, a bullman, who tested the qualities of whiskies at the local Glenochill distillery, a skilled profession for a strict teetotaler who was always punctual, steady, and sober. As with the Hagues, Donald's upbringing was dictated by two core beliefs: the family and serving God. So the rest of his early life, you can probably guess. Raised to be neat, clean, and polite, just like his son, Donald was a slightly undersized boy with a long, weary face and a thin, weedy frame, all barely held together by the expression of a haunted boy who fear had forced him to fold in on himself, as owing to an awkward birth, he walked with a stoop. And being just one in a family of nine, he never stood out, never felt loved, and always hid in the shadows. Surviving many brutally bitter winters in an austere Victorian era where only the rich had nest eggs to save them from the hard times ahead. Although the family were far from poor, their faith had taught them to spend frugally, live sparsely, waste nothing, and squirrel away whatever they could. Graduating from Menstrie Public School aged 13, young McSwan, who was Donald to his mum, never Don, boy to his dad, never son, and to his friends, well, he didn't have any friends. eager to appease his domineering father, who was never drunk, just disappointed. He earned a living at the distillery. But being swamped by three burly brothers, as a quiet bookish boy and the runt of the litter, who had learned to type and to take shorthand, instead of a tough, sweaty manual job, Donald became a clerk. Throughout his life, Donald feared his father. And as an unmarried man, being denied his independence, although he had never set foot out of Menstrie, let alone to the nearby cities of Edinburgh or Glasgow, in 1908, aged 30, holding everything he owned, Donald fled his home, his county, and his country, travelling 475 miles south to Tunbridge Wells in Kent. Whatever had caused this rift is unknown. He missed his family, he grieved their deaths, and he longed to be loved. But so deep was the pain that Donald never spoke or wrote to his parents ever again. That year, becoming the secretary at the Tunbridge Wells Spa Hotel, here he found work, a wage, a purpose, and a place to stay. As well as falling for the woman he would love until his dying day. Amy Beatrice Page was a waitress. Just like Donald, she was slight, quiet, and neat. A painfully shy Presbyterian who spoke in a tiny whisper, stood with a timid stance, and always avoided eye contact. And yet with Donald as her manager, she found love, support, strength, and someone who made her feel safe. Donald and Amy were a very decent couple, moral but modest, fiercely loyal but easily forgettable. They never kissed in public, yet always held each other's hand. They never wore bright colours, except for a little flower he popped into her lapel. And as two shy recluses, they said and did very little, but were always happiest together in their own home, away from the dangers of strangers. In October 1910, Donald and Amy fell pregnant. It was a blissfully jubilant time for the two solitary lovers, who one day dreamed of becoming a family. But conceived by mistake and born out of wedlock, that month, Donald and Amy hastily became the McSwans, having married in secret. On the 12th of May 1911, William Donald McSwan was born. A small but healthy boy, who as their only child, was always loved and hugged, given everything and denied nothing, raised well but never spoilt. Being different, he was never forced to be anything but himself. And no matter what, the McSwans would do anything to protect their beloved boy. Whether he was alive, dead, or allegedly in hiding. And yet, it was their lives which shaped the future of Mac McSwan, for better and for worse. In December 1915, with World War I raging, just as it would for his son quarter of a century later, 36-year-old Donald was conscripted to fight with the Royal Fusiliers on the French front line. As a small, weak, terrified pacifist with a stoop, whose religion forbade him to kill, and who cried every night that he didn't see his wife and baby, it's nothing short of a miracle that being little more than cannon fodder, Donald survived more than 2 years in the trenches. But in February 1918, his luck ran out. Being blasted by a mortar shell, his only physical injury was a small scar over his right eye. But the bloody war had taken its toll on Donald, and for the rest of his life, traumatized and plagued by night terrors, his right hand would perpetually shake with an involuntary tremor, a sad souvenir of the so-called Great War. Demobbed in July 1918, although he was hailed a hero and was given two medals, Donald swore that from this day onwards, he and his family would never be apart ever again. For the next 25 years, Donald, Amy, and William McSwan spoke daily, were parted rarely, and always wrote. But all that changed the day they met Johnny Haig. His subterfuge was simple.
I explained to them that Mac had gone off to avoid his call-up.
A dilemma Donald understood, which was why he supported his son's decision to do whatever he could do to avoid the draft.
I wrote a number of letters purporting to be from him.
The typed ones matched his typewriter. The signature was a perfect match. And the handwriting on the postcards mirrored his style, tone, and grammar. And having
posted them in Glasgow and Edinburgh,
the two nearest cities to Donald's hometown, he explained the
various details of the deposition of assets,
which were to be left to his old pal Johnny. And because of that, the retired recluses were reassured by their boy's words that he was fine, well, and he would be home soon. Unaware that he was already dead and dissolved. As per his letters, on the 18th of September 1944, 1 week after the murder, Donald arrived at his son's office to inform the workshop's owner that Mac was out of town on business indefinitely. On the 5th of September, Donald paid his son's rent at 22 Kempsford Gardens. He ended the tenancy and removed his boy's belongings, noting the items that Mac must have taken with him. A checkbook, a suitcase, a nice pen, a handful of letters, his best suit, and his imperial typewriter. The McSwans totally believed this logical ruse, that their beloved son had vanished by choice, was laying low, and for fear of alerting the police to his whereabouts, they never reported him missing. All the while, giving his killer ample time to destroy evidence, assume his identity, and steal his assets. Johnny's plan to murder for money was perfect. Sort of. The McSwans were so like the Haigs. Two devoted parents, neat, shy, and reclusive, who would do anything to protect their boy. But as Mac's life collapsed, as much as he trusted his old pal, Johnny was too arrogant to see his fatal mistake. Mac liked Johnny as a brother, but he wasn't family. On the 5th of November 1943, just as ex-con Johnny was seeking his first victim, having been released from Lincoln Prison, with the war draft looming closer, Mac did what many servicemen and civilians in wartime did and visited his bank, where he signed a power of attorney granting financial control of his affairs to the only people he trusted without question. His parents. Everything, from his bank accounts, to his stocks, to his shares and his company. Everything but his homes. Again, Johnny had made another fatal mistake, only this one was obvious. Just like his own parents, and to some extent Mac himself, Donald and Amy lived a very frugal life in a small, sparsely furnished top-floor flat in a less desirable part of town, rented weekly for just £1. And as a solitary couple who didn't own a car, didn't socialise or go on holiday, they scraped by on a meagre pension of 22 shillings a week. To Johnny, they looked like they didn't have two farthings to rub together. But to Donald and Amy, they had everything. Their family, their faith, and their fortune. Technically, Mac didn't have a single penny or asset to his name. But his family did. They always had. As their faith had taught them to live sparsely, waste nothing, and squirrel away their nest eggs, all three McSwans jointly owned and rented out the four homes in Beckenham, Wimbledon, and Raynes Park. So with total control over their son's assets, As much as Johnny's letters lied, it was all for nothing. Johnny's bank account was empty. Of his last £26, the basement had cost £7, the acids £3, and with a few shillings for sundries like letterheads, business cards, and his victim's last meal, in total, Mac's murder had cost him a tenner. And although, anticipating a rather wonderful windfall, he had slightly prematurely toasted his success with a teeny-tiny spending spree of a few suits from Hawks of Savile Row, exquisite din-dins at the Punch Bowl Club, good seats for classical concertos at the Albert Hall, a few big bets on the GGs and doggies at the White City Stadium, and several decent snoozes on soft linen sheets at the upmarket Onslow Court Hotel, for the princely sum of £5.01 a week, plus 10% service charge, obviously. But what irked him the most was the endless expense of chugging back and forth from London to Edinburgh to Glasgow, to post a few forged letters from the McSwan's dead son. Now a needless charade, which having cruelly teased him with a taste of the good life, and left a nifty little Armstrong Siddeley saloon stuck in the showroom, this whole grand plan had bled him dry. On the 12th of January 1945, aided by a stolen checkbook, a forged signature, and a devious little dollop of duping Mac's dad, Johnny siphoned off monies from one of Mac's accounts, a scam he would repeat on the 3rd of February and the 8th of March, draining £210, almost £8,300 today. Admittedly, this pitiful little sum would only tide him over for a bit. But it wasn't £250,000, which was rightfully his. If only he had a way to make Donald and Amy McSwan vanish completely.
I'd known the McSwans for several years. I took them separately to the basement, disposing of them in the same way as their son.
As before, he made it sound so simple, so precise, and so superior. But with no plan to become a serial killer, and believing that he was made for life, having offed a big mark like Mac, with all of the tools of his murderous deeds either destroyed or disposed of, Johnny would have to start from scratch. And although he was no longer a murder virgin, whereas the first of his six supposedly perfect murders was laughably inept, the second and third would be totally absurd. It's safe to say that little Johnny Haig hadn't learned his lessons. Having leased the basement at 79 Gloucester Road to Ronald Fontana, his perfect execution site had gone. So being unwilling to totally give it up, the two men agreed to split it. Ronald had the front room for his storage, and separated by a thin wall and a single door, Johnny had the back rooms for his murders. Still, at least he had sole access to the drain, so that was something. On the 10th of February, Johnny ordered a Winchester of hydrochloric and 3 10-gallon carboys of sulfuric. But with his funds dry, the check bounced, so the usually swift delivery of the bottles were delayed by a further 2 weeks, and Johnny's company had a black mark placed against their name. Having scrapped the drum and needing two, Johnny borrowed a set of old, rusty, and warped, but hopefully watertight 40-gallon steel drums of a local builder's merchant. Having almost scorched his hands and suffocated on the fumes, this time he would wear protection. Only being too cheap to buy, too lazy to borrow, and too superior to steal, he made do with an old tatty trench coat, a pair of leather gloves, and a makeshift gas mask made from cardboard and string. Again, having forgotten how impossible it was for a 150-pound man to decant a 165-pound carboy into a 4-foot-high steel drum, which took two men to lift. Once again, he opted to slop out the lethal liquid by bucket. And yes, as before, he failed to purchase possibly the most important thing, a murder weapon. So instead, the same shoddy crap he left lying around would have to suffice. A pinball table leg, a length of lead pipe, or an old hand axe. With the preparations for the double murder of the McSwans done and dusted, now all Johnny had to do was to lure this frail old couple into his lair, just as he had done with her son. But once again, he had overlooked one small detail which would prove to be his biggest mistake. Mac McSwan liked Johnny. He trusted him. But Donald and Amy did not. Over the next 4 months, Johnny struggled to speak to, let alone see the McSwans. As two shy and reclusive homebodies, who rarely went out, invited nobody in, and mostly communicated by letter, sometimes by phone, and once in a blue moon, on the communal doorstep at 45 Claverton Street. Even if he could lure them out, which he couldn't, be invited in, which he wasn't, or break in, which he couldn't, to murder them in their own home. Without a car or any transport, how would he cart two dead bodies from a top-floor flat in Pimlico to his basement 3 miles away in South Kensington? No, Johnny was well and truly stuck. And then it got worse. Unable to afford the extortionate train fare to Scotland, Johnny had to stop writing the letters. When Ronald Fontana moved out, for safety's sake, Johnny had to use his last penny to take up the full lease on the basement. And being broke, like a hobo with nowhere to go, he was forced to bunk down in the dark, dingy basement, asleep on an old mattress, surrounded by two steel drums, gathering dust. And then, it got even worse. On Monday the 30th of April 1945, with Hitler dead, the war over, and conscription to be abolished, as people cheered in the streets that their loved ones would soon be coming home, as Mac had been missing for 9 months, and silent for 3, the McSwans began to ask the question, where was our boy? And then, his whole plan collapsed. On Wednesday the 6th of June, Albert Marshall, estate agent at Taylor Lovegrove & Co., one floor above, gave Johnny 1 month's notice to vacate the basement. With no money left, no time to waste, and no other options, it was now or never. But how do you lure two shy recluses out of their home? On the evening of Monday the 2nd of July 1945,
I separately took to the basement the father Donald and the mother Amy, disposing of them in exactly the same way as their son.
As a frail elderly couple, one a petite lady with a tiny whisper, a timid stance, and a tiny flower in her lapel, and the other, an awkward battle-scarred veteran with a haunted face, a painful stoop, and a perpetually trembling hand, were easy kills. Coshed, hogtied, and drowned in sulfuric acid, as the twin drums shook, boiled, and the dirty fizzing stew stripped their hands, feet, and faces to the bone, Johnny stirred the deathly brew, his trench coat, leather gloves, and makeshift gas mask doing the job. And although we know that they both died that day, it's still uncertain whether they were dead, alive, or dying, as side by side, he dissolved their bodies in acid. But being an uncaring sort of chap, it's possible. 2 days later, all that remained was a black acrid gloop. Glug after glug, as little Johnny Haig wrestled to stop the steel drums from tipping over too far, and the hot, gooey residue of the elderly recluses slid into the dark, festering sewer behind the locked black door in the basement of 79 Gloucester Road. After 9 months of patiently waiting, praying, and hoping, finally, Donald and Amy McSwan were reunited with their boy. As per his tenancy, on the 6th of July 1945, Johnny vacated the premises. He had the empty carboys collected, and should they ever be needed, the drums relocated to Alan Stevens' yard at No. 2 Leopold Road. 11 days later, rightly assuming the banks and lawyers to be a pushover, Turner McFarlane McIntosh & Co., a firm of Glasgow solicitors, were asked to draw up a power of attorney for William Donald McSwan, Donald McSwan, and Amy Beatrice McSwan, assigning full control of their assets to John George Haig. ID was produced, all three signatures matched, and having checked the documents,
the solicitor would and did confirm that they were legal, because in his eyes, they were.
Selling off the business, their homes, and all stocks, savings, shares, and war bonds. In total, from these three murders, Johnny's pocket would be flush with enough cash to last a lifetime. With his bank balance brimming, his belly full of fine foods, and his suits stylish once again, as a dapper, sophisticated bachelor who was finally living the life that he deserved and had earned, Johnny became a permanent resident in room 404 of the exclusive Onslow Court Hotel, outside of which he had parked his brand new, rather nifty, dark green Armstrong Siddeley saloon. And now, his dream was complete. Johnny Haig was a wealthy middle-class man, living a lavish life in an affluent part of town. Yes, to get there, he had slaughtered three people, plundered their assets, dissolved their corpses, and poured their sludge down into the sewer. But as no one had reported them missing, where was the problem? In the end, it took very little effort to lure the McSwans into his lair. In fact, it was simple. Johnny had made many mistakes in his first three murders, the biggest being to assume that he knew his victims better than they knew themselves. And although the Haigs were very similar to the McSwans, by watching them, Johnny knew that they all had one fatal flaw, which he did not. Love. As two doting parents, who would do anything to protect their boy, having swallowed an entirely plausible story that their only son, a shamed petty criminal, a conscription deserter, and a secret homosexual, was missing. After 3 months of silence, when Johnny showed them proof of life in the basement of 79 Gloucester Road, they only saw what they wanted to see. The handwriting was a match, the date was recent, the postmark was local, and the loving words on the postcard reassured his worried parents that their boy was fine, well, and he would be home soon. By the summer of 1945, having made enough money to last a lifetime, the killing spree of John George Haig, one of Britain's most infamous serial killers, should have come to an end. But it didn't.
Sulfuring.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was part 3 of Sulfuric, The True Story of John George Haig, with the fourth part of six, continuing next week. A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Tracy Lawrence, Cindy Ortiz, Kim Cook, Stephanie Enns, and Jennifer Venn. With a special thank you to Kaz Every and Jason Abercrombie, the wonderful admins on the Murder Mile discussion group on Facebook. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
God. Oh, dear. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. Oh, dear God. Well, as you can hear, I got the winter bug is out. The winter bug is here. The bloody horrible thing. I was out yesterday. I even though I was ill, I had a private tour to do. So I did a tour. I've got another one today. What's today? Today's not quite December. So it's November. Oh, I think it's 24th today. It's the day after Dennis Nielsen's birthday. 24th of November this morning. So I've woken up really early this morning. Try and get this record done because I'm about 2 days behind now. The cold started creeping in on Friday, and then yesterday it was quite bad, and today So I'm gonna go and have a lem sip. That's why this record sounded a little bit throaty. If you listen to the others, when you get to the omnibus edition and you put on episode 3, you go, oh, it sounds weird. My voice has gone really throaty today, so. Put on some hot water, make some lem sip. That should do. Oh, so yeah, no cup of tea today, and just lem sip and all stuff like that. So hopefully that record was okay. I spent all my time basically going every sentence, blowing my nose and coughing and spluttering. Oh, I hope it sounds okay. Oh, I just couldn't. I thought to myself, I can't afford to wait any longer because otherwise the episodes will be delayed and. It doesn't sound too bad, it just sounds throaty. So how are you all? You're good? I can't hear you. Are you all good? Yay! Normally I write some notes on here of things that I must remember to say, but I haven't written anything today. I was in such a rush to get stuff done, to get this episode finished, because I was going to record yesterday, but then I realised the episode wasn't quite right, and I had to go through it and write it. Through it again to make sure, because there are bits and pieces that I was uncertain about. So what's that? So diet's still going well. What this must be like week 9 now. I have had some cakes. I'm trying to introduce some cakes back into the system. Had a little bit of chocolate, but not too much. I went up to see my gran up in Scotland the other day. She 800 mile round trip. She was fast asleep. She woke up, she looked at me, she went straight back to sleep. She didn't even recognise me or chocolate. But anyway, so I had a twirl in my pocket, so I had a bit of twirl. It was fine. When you go on a diet, I always keep thinking to myself, oh, it'll be exciting. Do you know, when you go back, you have all the things that you miss and you enjoy them. And it's just, every time I try something that I haven't had in a while, it's not as exciting as I remember, like chocolate or cake. Yeah, I'd like some burgers yesterday because I thought, let's put some red meat back in my system. And it was fine. It was fine. But it was all the while I kept thinking, it'd be nice to have some leeks and some garlic. I'm quite enjoying the nice, even though it's not really diet food, it's kind of just good, decent food that is not the processed shit. I hate processed shit. I really don't like that stuff. I hate anything that has sauce with it. Do you know, if you buy something that's already got sauce with it, I always think it's a bad idea because it's like, it's like saying, here you go, here's one flavour. That's why I don't get it. It's like, do you know, loads of meals, like pasta meals. It's like, there you go, it's all covered in a tomato sauce. Yeah? What else? Whereas with my meals, because they're all separate, like you've got your fish and you've got your leeks with your garlic and you've got your olives there and you've got your feta cheese there and the eggs there and rye bread there. And it's all, you've got all your different flavours in different parts of the plate. And I quite like that. Which is why I kind of, oh, maybe I'll have a treat myself to a Sunday roast today. Ooh, that'd be nice. Oh, that'd be nice. Yeah, I think I'm going to have it. No, that's it. Decided. I'm going to treat myself to a Sunday roast. I earned some good money yesterday doing a private tour for Heather. It was for Heather and Heather's mum and family. Hopefully I've converted them into Murder Mile listeners, so maybe they're listening to this episode, so that was very good. Hope the tour went well for them. They were really good. They were really into their true crime. They didn't know about Murder Mile, but they're into true crime, and that was good fun, so I was able to chat to them about different murders, and I think two of them were ex-police as well, which is always useful. So we had a bit of a giggle, we had a laugh. Even though I was very, very ill and very, very drugged up. All on my way there, I was thinking, I hope they listen to the podcast. Because if they listen to the podcast, what I can do is say, let's not do a regular Murder Mile. Let's just do a... let me show you around all the sites and I'll do a kind of an off-the-cuff tour. Which is what I'm planning to do anyway soon, is kind of an off-the-hoof tour of Murder Mile. So if you've been on the regular tour, it's structured and it's scripted, whereas what I want to do is something a little bit more free-flowing. So I was planning to do that, but because they'd never heard of Murder Mile before, and I was like, bollocks, I'll have to do the full tour. But because they were good fun, they know about their true crime, and you know, we were able to kind of improvise around it, and we had a lot more fun. So yeah, it was good. It lasted just over three hours instead of the normal 2 hours. But it was good fun. We enjoyed it. So that was good. Oh, I've had so many Lemsips. Oh, I've got another tour to do in a couple of hours. Actually, no. I've got to get on my bike. I've got to cycle all the way down to Pimlico to go to 45 Claverton Street to film the location for there. And then, even though I've already filmed... the front of 79 Gloucester Road. It was when writing these episodes, because I filmed these locations earlier on, I realised now that I need to go back and film what it looks like in Stanhope Mews West, behind 79 Gloucester Road, where the first murder location was. So I need to go there and film the back, because I think that would be quite interesting. So I need to do that one, and I'm going to go and film Onslow Court, which comes into its own in the later episodes. If you've listened to all three so far, you'll notice that... I mean, even if you know the case, you'll notice that I've been drip-feeding you bits of information. I've told you the stories, but I've drip-fed you information. You probably won't have noticed it, hopefully, but I've drip-fed you little pieces of information about places which will crop up later on. So later on, you'll go, that makes sense. Okay, that's in there now. Or, do you know, it won't come as a shock. Do you know, there's names in there that you've already heard already, so... So I'm covering all my bases on this. I'm going to have to sit down and really work out how to write Eps 4, 5 and 6 tomorrow. I've got them all. I've got all the research there and it's done. I put them in an order, but now I just need to... Now I've done the first three. Now I need to work out how to do the next six. But I enjoyed that one. I thought that was quite interesting episode, doing the Donald and Amy McSwan. It's a hard one to write. There's no photo of Donald, the father. I've put some photos online of Amy. There's very little about Amy's life. She's very quiet and she kept to herself, and there's very few details about it. So, we'll mention some of this very shortly. So, I tell you what, let's get into that now, because I can't think. I can't think what I'm meant to be doing. I'm all over the shop today. Where were we? Okay, removal of the drums. As mentioned in there, see, this is the thing with Haig, same as with Christie as well. He's detailed with some things, but vague with other things. There's a real kind of mishmash of what they choose to want to, which is why I always say on things, you know, just because a serial killer says something or a murderer says something, it doesn't mean it's fact. You don't have to take it as gospel. If anything, I would not take it as gospel at all. Because they are notoriously liars. That's why they end up in the you know, they end up doing crime. They're liars. They don't know how to live a normal life. So, you know, and especially with people like Haig and Christie and Blackout Ripper, it's all about themselves. They're all very self-centred. They're all liars by trade. So, you know, anything they say is complete bullshit. So, but with all of them, it all is very vague. It's like they will say one thing, they will contradict it elsewhere. You know, you can't really trust them. Many of the details in these episodes are quite vague in places. Like how... I was going to do a big section on this in the podcast, but I cut it out when I was writing about how do they get Donald and Amy McSwan from the top floor flat at 45 Claverton Street to his dingy basement in Pimlico. Now, it's a nice flat, though, and a relatively nice flat. Not posh, but it was, you know, it was nice, but it was secure. The basement in South Kensington, 79 Gloucester Road. The front entrance, I can't show you. I'll probably show you a picture on social media. I can't put it on my website because it's copywritten. Patron subscribers will see a picture of it. The front entrance to it was quite nice. It looked relatively decent, but it was a basement and it was underneath shops. Back entrance, not so nice. So it's kind of hard. It was easier obviously to lure William in, the son, because the son was going there for business purposes. He was like, oh, this is Johnny, this is your new business, this is Union Group Engineering, that's very exciting, I'll come and see this. So even though this was never stated why he was going there, that would be the reason why he was going there. The parents, harder to lure them in, harder to get them out of the house. They didn't really leave the house much. They would go and collect the rent of the properties they went to, but they didn't go out anywhere. They didn't trust strangers, even though they knew Johnny, you know. he was not someone who was high on their list of people they trusted. Yes, they invited him round for tea, but that, don't forget, that was with their son. So with their son there, you know, they trust their son, their son's instincts. But there was never a point where they would go, all right, mate, come on round, have a couple of beers round our flat. It was like, you know, they didn't trust him at all. So only they would communicate with him by letter or sometimes by phone. Or as mentioned, if he did call, they would have to come down from the top floor flat to the communal doorstep at the bottom next to the landlady and the other tenants, one of whom was her daughter. And they would talk to him on the doorstep but never invite him up. So they were quite a cautious couple. So how do you get them from Claverton Street to there? That's 2.8 miles. They didn't have a car. He didn't have a car. Do you know? He couldn't get in, as mentioned. he couldn't break in. He couldn't get any keys. He wasn't a burglar. Burglar. So, yeah. I was going to do more about this, but it was just like... I decided to strip it out a little bit. There were details that are missing. So where he got those two drums from, we don't know. He didn't mention about that. Basically, he said he asked around. Obviously, he found the first steel drum in the churchyard of St. Stephen's. It was a bit worn out. Second time, he didn't really find any that he could find. He needed two. He needed some good ones. So he asked around in the local pubs. He asked Ronald Fontana. Apparently he got them from a local builder's merchant. He said he borrowed, well, he said he traded, but he didn't say what he traded them with. That's all we really know about that. But, so the drums, yeah. When Johnny Hague had moved out of the basement, obviously he'd moved out on the 6th of July, as per the contract. Albert C. Marshall, of Taylor Lovegrove, noticed two large 40-gallon drums between the middle room and the way out to the mews at the back. He wrote to John George Hague on the second... Oh, God, burpees. Oh, it's all this Lemsip. It's not good for my hernia. Oh. He wrote to John George Hague on the 2nd of August asking him to remove them. Johnny asked Albert to send a letter to the Union Tool and Gauge Company, which was Alan Stevens' company, to have them removed. Alan, who of course is Barbara's father, Barbara might possibly pop up later on, I haven't decided, and had them shipped to Crawley, where they were placed in their yard at number 2 Leopold Road, which was basically the storeroom that Johnny had helped kind of clean up in between his times during prison. The drums were collected by Francis Ridley, a lorry driver, and delivered that day. Obviously, they could have been scrapped, but, you know, they didn't know whether they'd need them again or whether they'd be of any use to anyone. I really don't think at this point that Hague is thinking about extra murders. I think he was just like, could be useful. Do you know, maybe could sell them, or do you know what? Maybe who knows? I mean, he doesn't discuss this, so maybe, who knows? Maybe he kind of looked at them and thought, maybe there might be more murders. I don't know. Maybe I might need to do this again. So, who knows? As always, yep, the carboys were collected. Three carboys this time, 365-pound carboys were collected, all empty or as near as empty, on the 10th of July. I'll probably mention this next time. I don't think I put this in the episode this time. The axe that was there, I'll probably mention this next time, I think. I'll put it in the next episode. The axe that was there, the wooden axe, now whether this was the murder weapon or not, or whether it was the lead pipe, or whether it was one of the legs of the pinball table. Johnny Hague bequeathed the axe to Mr. Albert Marshall, who was the landlord there. So he had the axe. So whether that was a murder weapon or what, not, we don't know. The basement was small, and it had a bit of a toxic smell to it, but because he'd explained that he was doing experiments, he said it was to do with plastics. That was kind of accepted. They opened up the windows and they opened up the doors and aired it out, and it was fine. What else we got? Probably put this into next week's episode as well. So obviously he not only took their ID, he took all the registration, national registration identity cards of Donald McSwan, William Donald McSwan, and Amy. Her full name was Amy Beatrice Sarah McSwan. He also took all of their ration books as well. So, quite a petty man, even though he'd nicked, what did I say it was? It was just over £200,000 today, which I know it doesn't sound a lot, but the equivalent back then, it's like, it's hard to explain. Like back then, you could buy a house for what was the equivalent of £17,000. Like, if you're in London now, you'd be lucky if you could buy a flat for £250,000, but you know, back then, the equivalent of £17,000. So, you know, the cost of things were a lot cheaper back then. Obviously, your money went up a lot further. So even though it doesn't, £200,000, you'd think to yourself, well, that probably wouldn't last him a long time. That would probably last him like a year or two. Do you know, or they'll probably last most people a year or two. But, you know, back then, that was a sizable chunk of money. oh, dear. So as mentioned on the 17th of July 1945, John Turner McFarlane, solicitor at Turner McFarlane McIntosh & Co. at 24 Blythewood Square in Glasgow, received a call from supposedly from William Donald McSwan, obviously this was John George Hague, asking him to draw up a power of attorney. and he asked for an appointment. The man arrived, claimed to be William Donald McSwan. Obviously, he had his ID, perfect signature. It wasn't a photo ID because this was in the era before. Well, I mean, obviously, you'd have photos in passports and things like that, but you could have a photo ID, but they'd be quite easy to do because it's basically just a picture and you glue it in. Not really that difficult, but they use signatures to prove ID. The man arrived, wanted to create a power of attorney of William Donald McSwan in favour of John George Hague. It was dated 18th of July 1945. The work was done that day. It was completed the next day. It was lodged at the central office of the High Court. John George Hague admitted that he wrote all the signatures himself. Sorry, I was just reading ahead. Yep, signatures were a match. ID was a match. So no real problem there. The document let John George Hague accept the transfer of any stocks, funds, shares, annuities and other securities which shall or may at any time hereafter be transferred to me, John George Hague, to take possession of my freehold premises, 9 Grand Drive, these are the houses, 106 Kenilworth Drive, 15 Wimborne Way, and 122 Churchfields Road. And obviously, as mentioned, the solicitor looked at these documents, and they all seemed fine. These were drafted on William Donald McSwan's Imperial typewriter, so he actually used one of his victim typewriters to draft these documents. They're quite simple documents. He'd seen them many times before, as mentioned. So we did all this in episode one, where he already knew a lot about law. He'd got access to legal papers. He'd got access to power of attorneys. He'd looked to them. They're all pretty much much of a muchness, really. So no real difference there. When he was finally arrested at Brixton Prison, he was shown these documents by Chief Inspector Guy Mahon, who we've heard about before on the Blackout Ripper. He was shown the forged power of attorney, and he said, "Yes, I signed McSwan's name. I remember I made. I didn't make a good job of the last signature. Instead of Donald, I wrote Ponald." I think if you go on my my website, it's on there on the blog. It doesn't hugely look like Ponald, but it looks like Donald, but the swirl is a little bit higher than it should be. But apart from that, but there was, actually going through this, though, there was even though they had lots of houses and all that, Donald and Amy McSwan actually had a lot more money that was hidden away. They had a lot of investments. I was kind of looking at like where all their funds were. They had a lot of bank accounts as well, but also they had a hell of a lot of investments. They had a lot of war bonds and savings and stocks and shares. So in total, in addition to their homes that were on there and William Donald McSwan's business that was there and his savings, on top of that was at least another £100,000 in today's value, just on Donald's and Amy McSwan's bonds and shares. They had a lot of war bonds. So, they were... Oh, I think I might have it all here. So he made the equivalent of... from these three murders, £214,000, £548, which at the time was the equivalent of 1,000 people's average annual salary. So that's a lot of money. So that really puts it into perspective how much, sorry, that's disgusting, how much money he had actually nicked. That's a lot of money. He also said, I have since got additional ration books by producing the identity cards in the usual way. Which he did, which is kind of a bit mean in a way. You know, he's nicked all of their money and their possessions and their assets and all things like that. And then he also goes and gets their ration books. He's like, yeah, what the hell? Assets of the McSwans, obviously, they've got the house in Beckenham. I won't. I'm gonna not give away too much on here because I'm probably gonna. I'm gonna open up with the deposition of assets in the start of the next episode because I think there's some interesting things to say there. But yeah, I don't want to give too much away. So yeah, no, they had post office savings accounts. They had war defense bonds. What else did they have? There's quite a few bank accounts, so I'm just trawling through their bank accounts. Not literally trawling through their bank accounts, just having a look at what they've got. Hang on. Obviously, should just mention that Max Automatics, don't forget, this has already been sold. So when I say that his business has been sold, that's McSwan Engineering, because Max Automatics has already gone the pinball business. What else we got? Oh, see, there's things here that I just... Oh. See, I put it into Extra Mile thinking I might talk about this later on, but I don't know what I know how I'm going to open up F4, but I don't want to give too much away just in case. Maybe some of these might go into Extra Mile next week. That's the danger of doing multi-part series is I'm constantly going between all six episodes, all the research on all six, and double checking everything and then going, oh right, what have I said there? Right, I need to say that week, but I need to make sure I don't say that this week, and then that, okay, that was said in week one, so I need to bring that back up. These really are complicated. You're probably enjoying them and going, oh, this sounds nice. I'm enjoying these. These are real, real difficult to write. They take twice as long to write as any other episodes. But I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying doing it as the Johnny. I think it's different because we haven't really played the character, the villain before. And it's all this is from the villain's perspective. So, yeah. Not that I'm trying to make him sympathetic, he's far from sympathetic, he's a bit of a prick, but I think that's an interesting way to do it. So yeah, 2nd of August 1945, so sure, like 3 weeks after the murders, he went to a garage in South Kensington, it doesn't say where it was, and he bought the dark green Armstrong Siddeley Saloon. Oh, it's the car he'd always wanted, and finally it was his. Don't forget, he was a big lover of cars. We mentioned this in episode one. He had three before, got sent to prison. They all got taken away from him. He had already spent a little while in the Onslow Court Hotel, just around the corner. He'd spent a couple of nights there every so often, but it's quite expensive, obviously. As mentioned, it's just over £5 a week to stay there. My notes here say £5.15. I thought it was £5.01. Well, phew. I'm not going to bother to double check that. I can't be asked. Yeah, it's one single furnished room. Obviously, he couldn't afford to live there when everything went tits up, and then he had to move into the basement, and he was living in the basement, and the basement obviously didn't have a bed. He didn't have a kitchen. It was grotty. It was horrible. Someone had been murdered there. But finally he moved back into the Onslow Court Hotel. I'll do a video of that later on when I get there, so you can see what it looks like. It hasn't changed. It's still the same. And this kind of location comes into its prominence then. Ooh, laboratory examination. No, let's not do anything there. No, let's save that bit. So bits. Oh, there's more bits that I can probably tell you, but I don't know what I'm going to open with next week. Yeah. Let me not add. I'm not going to add those. I'm not going to tell you about those, only because I just don't want to ruin it. Just in case next week I go, oh, this is interesting, and I put it into the episode, and then all of a sudden I realize that, and then I have to come back and edit out Extra Mile, which I don't like doing. So I think that might be it. That might be it for the week. Yeah, you don't want too much Extra Mile. You can have too much of a bad thing. There's Coot outside. Coot has been this is when I woke up at 5 to start recording, because I've got to do the tour and I've got to get on my bike and do that. And I thought, oh great, it's before dawn, so the birds won't be awake, and, you know, The muggers don't wake up until like late afternoon. The muggers around here are thick as shit. They really are. I mean, I'm in an area where there's a lot of muggings going on. God, they're thick as shit. I know to be a mugger you don't need special skills, but they are thick as shit. It's like they walk, this is them, they walk along the streets. I'm in East London at the moment. They walk along the streets. They're normally in groups of between four or sometimes as many as 15. They're all wearing black. They're all got ski masks on. Okay, none of them are going skiing. They don't have any ski poles with them. They don't have their skis with them, right? So they're really obvious. The ones going past had like a little sound block with them, so they were playing some music while they were walking along. Everyone around here knows them because it's the same group who do all the muggings all the time. They're really obvious, and it's just like, you thickest pieces of shit in the world. It's like, firstly, we all know that you're the muggers. Secondly, you're wearing ski masks, which is really ridiculous. It, you know, it makes you seem more obvious. You got your music blaring. I was cycling along one of the routes the other day and drifting down, I could smell the fog of cannabis. I was like, oh, the muggers are up there. I could smell them before I could see them. They really are that stupid. They have no idea what they're doing. They're just so vague. And also, because they're in groups, like, they'll steal someone's bag, go and get their credit card, and then they go to the bank. And let's say maximum, they get at the maximum, which is 300 quid, okay? 300 quid. Let's say there's a group of them that's 15. 300 divided by 15, I know they probably haven't passed GCSE maths, but there's 20 quid each. 20 quid each. Even if it's only two of them, that's still only 150 quid. That's in today, not really much. Do you really want to go to prison? And probably be charged with not just mugging, but, you know, if you're carrying a knife. 10 years for carrying a knife, and then that's classified as armed robbery as well. For 150 quid? Get a job, mate. Go and stack some shelves. It's like, thick as pig shit. Anyway. That's me done, I think. I'm gonna have a stab at editing this today. I'm gonna check that the sound was okay, and then we're done. And then I'm gonna do my tour and then come back and probably die. So that was fun. Hope you enjoyed that. I'll catch you all soon. Best wishes, lots of love. Tatty bye. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.